welcome to the Morbid Anatomy Transmission. I'm your host, Molly McBride Jacobson. Judy Jackson gave a talk at the Morbid Anatomy last month. Perhaps you were there. She discussed the history of criminal insanity, the intersection of medicine and law that designates someone incapable of responsibility for their crimes, but also too dangerous to be exonerated. This episode is obviously coming out much later than the talk itself, but in conversation with Judy, we discussed a lot of stuff that didn't make it into her talk, so give a listen. Where and when did this diagnosis rise up?
Well, there's kind of a curve. Over history, there was always a recognition that there were people among us who weren't really fully competent in possession of their mental faculties, responsible for their actions, whether it be violent against another or themselves. But in terms of the court making specific legislation or provisions for those who were found to be both criminal and insane, not until 1800,
wow.
Very, very conveniently right at the turn of the 19th century, when one attempted assassination act led to the commission of the Criminal Lunacy Act.
What was that assassination attempt?
That was a former soldier who had obtained a number of very serious head wounds. So was not in his right mind, and it was quite apparent to all. His name was James Hadfield. He tried to kill the king at the opera, mostly because he knew that it was morally wrong for himself to commit suicide, which he really wanted to do. He wanted to let the courts take him out, what we call suicide by cop now, really. And he did not want to harm the king, but he felt that he was impelled or compelled to act in this way by voices, a higher authority, and it was recognized that his wounds sustained in battle, defending king and country, exempted him from personal culpability or responsibility. But that something had to be done. Just saying somebody was not guilty didn't protect society from them in the future. So there had to be a way to take care of them, confine them, that wasn't considered punishment necessarily. And that meant instead of incarceration in prison or hanging, to be consigned to an asylum.
Interesting. That's very tragic. That's a tragic story.
There's so many more.
Yeah, I mean, oh gosh. I mean, all of this is just incredibly tragic because it does seem like this category of person who is incapable of taking care of themselves and who is, I was thinking this morning about, like, the village idiot, mm-hmm. you know, which is funny because it almost sounds like an elected position. And as such, mental institutions are a part of, in one way or another, are a part of society way, way, way back.
What, in the 13th century.
But I mean, even then, you know, you have, even before then, you have these people who are, like you said, acknowledged as being not mentally fit.
Infirm,
which is infirm,
yeah. Febrile, idiots.
Yes, yeah.
There were many, many different words, none of which we would consider politically correct.
Yeah.
But there was a recognition, and unless those people were so disturbed that they were aggressive and violent, for the most part, like you said, the village idiot was allowed to assume a part. He actually had a role to play in the culture, not in our Western Anglo-American so much, but in others. For instance, he might have even been designated as a wise man or shaman. I'm primarily looking at the 19th century, mm-hmm. when there really was an arc, when the medical profession began to embrace psychiatry, although it wasn't known then, and the courts as well. In terms of medical testimony, witnesses appearing in court, up until then, it had been pretty much understood that the casual observer was able to make these judgment calls. The neighbors, the coworkers, the family, the friends, things were pretty apparent when somebody was babbling unintelligibly, believed that they were possessed by wizards or fairies, evinced mania or prolonged and profound melancholia. These terms, which are not that different now, were very much in usage. And even the layperson was a good observer and gave good accounts in court of these observations of their neighbor who just was not right in the head ever since he fell off the horse. With women, a lot of it, of course, was really around the menses and childbirth.
Do you feel like these designations are culturally produced, or do you feel like there is some validity to any of the diagnoses that we've, which is, I realize that's a tricky question.
In a way the trickiest, because absolutely I believe that there are people who are dangerous, whose mental faculties are unhinged, mm-hmm. to put it in one way, who are overwhelmed, who have some kind of psychoses, a delusion. That was the most recognized form of mental illness, even in historical times, meaning that their thought patterns may be disordered, their emotional processes, their ability to perceive a commonly recognized reality. Now, that's a continuum. For some people, they're just a little odd or eccentric. Other people become extremely violent and dangerous. There are people who seem to have no conscience, no empathy, no ability to identify with or have sympathy for their fellow human beings and want to exploit and harm them in any way possible. What do we do with them? Up until even into this century, or the last century really, people were confined to the attics. And it's one thing to be born with an infirmity, to have something that cripples, say, the mind as it would the body, rather than to develop into somebody who is amoral, immoral, hedonistic, usury.
Yeah, I was going to say, it does seem like with this diagnosis, there is such a moral element to it. Like the criminally insane diagnosis is like an evil diagnosis.
So sick versus evil is a huge concept here. Can someone be both? Is someone mentally ill also insane? In this country, for the last 50 years, insanity and mental illness are actually different terms. Insanity is only a legal term. It's only used in medical, legal, jurisprudence settings.
Huh, I had no idea.
I know most people don't. So it's insane. Sure, that's common parlance, but it's actually only used in the courtroom, whereas mental illness is a far more inclusive term that encompasses a larger proportion of the population. That includes depression, it includes anxiety.
It's a much more sympathetic term.
Yeah, and a lot of that is just coded in the DSM, which I'll be talking about, the contemporary classification system, primarily for insurance reimbursement.
Oh, God. Oh, wow.
So the judgments, they try very hard, right? Supposedly to be objective. Mm-hmm. However, of course, and this is one of the biggest problems with psychiatry and psychology in general, let alone having it used in the courts, is that, of course, no one can be completely objective. There are subjective impressions. In the 19th century, this really played out around morality, religion, and different diagnostic labels, indicating whether someone was responsible or not. And if somebody seemed to be in their right mind, in other words, not suffering from delusions, it's not that God made me do it, they were considered to be primarily egotistical, prideful, wanting attention, which is really interesting in light of some of the charges being leveled against the young mass shooters today, the copycats. That was brought up in medical testimony. Absolutely, the words evil, depraved, morbid pathology were thrown around a lot. And then there was sympathy. So this is a huge issue, sick versus evil. And it's never going away.
So you mentioned classifications, and I wanted to ask about that. How did we come to these categories of, I think some I wrote down were, one, moral insanity, two, degenerates. So where do we get these categories? Who thinks them up, and what are the classifications?
Yes, right here.
Throwing your books
Diagnostic
around.
Yeah, and Statistical here. Manual of Mental Disorders. This is the DSM-5. And there's been a lot of changes since, I believe, the first edition in 1923. Mm-hmm. A lot of what prompted this, actually, Molly, was shell shock in World War I. Because this gets really interesting, and I won't be going so much into this in the lecture, so
please
happy to
ahead.
Share yeah. some other things. Soldiers were evincing signs that had always been associated with women and hysteria. We now call it post-trauma stress disorder, sometimes conversion disorder, which is a somatization or an actual physicalization of mental anguish, which is so unbearable, the personality, in a way, cannot bear it, cannot process it. And so some part of the mind, neurologically, some pathway becomes confused or shuts down, is blocked. Again, there are so many different theories around this. But when men started showing the same symptomology that women had, well, they couldn't call that. That would just be even more humiliating for the men. So it was deemed shell shock. And eventually now, you know, there's been Gulf War syndrome. There's been a lot of different terms, and these labels change, they evolve, including moral insanity, which originally kind of meant something along the lines more of emotional disturbance, kind of a heightened tendency towards freneticism, maybe, or what we call emotional lability, which is a quick transitioning through moods. Someone who was not in control or in possession of their faculties. Whereas later in the 19th century, it evolved more towards what we now would align with sociopathy or psychopathy.
Before the DSM, what was the system of classification?
There really wasn't one. They had certain beliefs and theories, and they saw that some forms of treatment seem to be effective at calming people down. We might consider them barbarous, although interestingly enough, variations of such treatments, including packing people in cold sheets or dunking them in cold water over and over again, were used up until the 50s. And electric convulsive shock therapy is an electronic version of that kind of shock, putting someone into cold water over and over. It's kind of knocking the wind out of their sails in a way. If you're that exhausted, you can't really rant and rave. If you're manacled to a wall, you're not gonna lash out. There are far too many people who are deemed dangerous. There absolutely is a moral component still. There's no escaping that. But there's also no escaping the fact that there are a certain number of humans among us who, for the protection of everyone else, have to be sequestered.
You mentioned electroshock therapy and cold water treatments. What are some other methods of treatment that have been used throughout the history of the criminally insane diagnosis, and are they effective?
Well, now, primarily psychotropic medications are used. And there's, again, a lot of controversy over how effective they are. They may be, and they are, often helpful in, for instance, diminishing audio hallucinations or command voices, self-injuring or harming others. But they can also create a lot of deficits.
And it is crazy to think about the intersections. This is getting very heady now, but it's crazy to think about the intersections between our corporeal selves and the law. And I think that it particularly applies to mental health.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because the body was the instrument for treating the mind. Drop the body temperature, confine them, in some cases torture with the Inquisition. So the body has always been the instrument to which to reach the mind. When you're looking at insanity as a defense, because that's what it is, it's a defense, and it's a defense that's only raised in about 1% of contemporary trials, and there were about 300 and something uses of it between the, like, around 1760 to 1840. So when you're looking at that, everything is about motive. And one thing that was said over and over again is, well, there was no motive. And when there's no motive, well, then the person is obviously insane, because there has to be a motive, whether it's, you know, jealousy or greed. Usually the sane person who murders has a reason for it. And the insane person often has a reason to. It's just that their reason only makes sense within their delusional pattern of thinking and belief system. Even with all our considerably more advanced neuroimaging mechanistic knowledge, with all our abilities to actually observe the brain, we can't see the mind. We can put a PET scan and supposedly see which parts of the mind light up under certain stimulus. Parts of the mind light up, actually a lot of different parts of the mind light up around religiosity. And many people with delusions of persecution also have heightened hyper-religiosity, especially those with epilepsy.
Gosh.
I think New York in particular has a very rich history, and that visiting some of the abandoned asylums, like you said, you know, the sense of desolation, of human waste, the sorrow, the pain and suffering, the anguish, it's almost unbearable to consider how many lives were lost. It's funny because, you know, I really want to help people be clear about, you know, the history of this and why it matters still. These issues aren't going away. And if anything, we're kind of deeming more and more people to be pathological or abnormal. There seems to be less tolerance even for charming eccentricity or being an oddball. So a lot is lost when we dismiss people as deranged and deviant without examining what went into that. There's a lot of narratives, there's a lot of storytelling, which makes these criminal cases particularly interesting, is because this is where the sort of the contemporary storytelling of the court narrative, the legal drama, began.
That's all for this transmission. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy the podcast, please rate and review it on iTunes. I so appreciate it. Judy Jackson has a background in yoga, musical theater, and forensic psychology. She's also the founder of Full Force Forensics, which links together media and art and criminal justice. You can find out more about Judy and her work at fullforceforensics.com. The current Morbid Anatomy exhibit is House of Wax. It's Victorian-era wax figurines that lie somewhere between art and science, beauty and horror. And lucky you, the exhibit has been extended till April 3rd. As for events, As Above, So Below, Art of the American Fraternal Society is on January 20th, and The Executioner, Unhooded, is on the 30th, among so many others. For more info or to buy tickets, go to morbidanatomymuseum.org. Today's last words come from mob boss Dutch Schultz. In a stream of consciousness nonsense confession after being taken out by his competitors, he said, "Okay, I am all through. Can't do another thing. Police, Mama, Helen, Mother, please take me out. I will settle the indictment. Come on, open the soap ducats, the chimney sweeps, talk to the sword. Shut up, you got a big mouth. Please help me up, Henry, Max. Come over here. French-Canadian bean soup. I want a penny.